Good morning and welcome to the 21st. I'm Lamont Holden, filling in while Brian Mackey takes a few days off. Look, my background is a little different than some of our other guest hosts. I'm a professor of music production at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, as well as a podcast host, videographer, and sound designer. Tomorrow, myself and a few of our guests will debut a new Illini anthem that I've reimagined with some of my musical collaborators, so be sure to tune into that to hear what I hope will become the University of Illinois' new fight song. But today, we're starting with an issue I'm familiar with, social justice. Nearly a year ago, I shared a perspective in the News Gazette in Champaign about being Black in America. The newspaper asked many African Americans to share stories and solutions in the wake of George Floyd's killing. It reads, in part, "It's hard to be Black every day. It's hard. I'm tired. I have to admit that my life has prepared me for the everyday run-of-the-mill oppression that I'm tasked to fight and work in advocacy against on behalf of others, but this is different. I'm afraid to die. I think about it every day. I consider my own mortality daily." The article was read by many people, including my first guest, State Senator Scott Bennett, who reached out to me after my article appeared. State Senator Scott Bennett represents the 52nd State Senate District, which includes the Greater Champaign Area, Danville, Rantoul, and Georgetown. And he joins me now. Senator Bennett, good morning, and thanks for joining me here on the 21st.
Lamont, good morning. It's good to talk with you. Though you were talking about your background, I will say you've got one of the better radio voices that I've heard. I don't like the juxtaposition of my voice next to yours on that, but I'll try to hang with you at least for content.
Senator, stop playing, but I definitely appreciate you. And it's good to see you again. I know we had a chance to speak briefly off the record back in June, but I wanted to go ahead and get started. Here's where I wanted to go. So when you read my piece in the News Gazette, why did you feel compelled to reach out to me?
I think we're in such need of solutions. And the fact is, the old solutions we have tried clearly aren't the solutions that we'd hoped for. So it's when I see someone who's bringing something new to the table, a different perspective, a different way to try to approach this issue that we all acknowledge exists, that's compelling to me. And I thought your story was interesting and your perspective was really refreshing. So I was really grateful that when we reached out to you, that you then said, okay, let's sit down and talk about it. Of course, I really enjoyed our time sitting and get to know each other a little bit.
I appreciate that. Now, I'd personally like to say, there's policy, there's things we want to do to improve our community, but first there's who we are as human beings. And just getting that clip in that article, it made me feel better. It made me feel heard, right? Thank you, and I appreciate that. Thank you. The piece centers around my own fear of the police as a Black citizen, and I know I'm not alone, right? So Senator Bennett, what do you say to African Americans in this district who fear law enforcement?
Well, this has been, I think, what has been very eye-opening to a lot of, certainly a lot of the, elected leaders, but also just stakeholders in the community. And I think we talked about this a little, Lamont. I'm from a small town outside Champaign, a few thousand people. I knew all my police officers by name. We might even hang out socially because there's just not that many people around, and we were friendly. So for me, a police interaction was always a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's only been in the last few years, and I was a prosecutor after law school and got to know police officers here on the local level and like them. But what has been eye-opening to me is how many people with different experiences, different backgrounds, have a very different reaction to police mm-hmm. officers. Mm-hmm. And so I, for example, would put, most of my cases as a prosecutor were small children that had been abused in some way. And so when I would get to know them and, they'd been through a lot, they were small. One comment that came up more than once with, I would say, well, this is going on for months. Why didn't you tell your teacher? Why didn't you tell anybody? Often they would say to me, I was told not to talk to the police, or like, don't trust a police officer. And it was such a, like, wow, okay. And because the first reaction to people with a different background is, well, you must have something illegal going on in your house, or you wouldn't have that attitude.
Yeah.
The fact is, and something that is largely required video evidence to kind of make us realize the situation is that some people, just their experiences are just very different. The police in their communities act very differently. And from a very young age, you have a distrust of authority, particularly law enforcement, which then only exacerbates as you get older. So it's not only, oh, the police aren't here to help me, it's the police are here to do something that might put me in harm. And so that to me is not something that I can say that I've always known, but I do hear it, and I hear it a lot from people in the community. And what I'm trying to do now is recognize my experience isn't everybody's experience, and to try to find some way that we can help bridge that gap, because most law enforcement officers, I think, go into law enforcement, and I do believe this, to help. And so they don't understand when they say, well, why would you run when you see me come up? Why would you not tell me something was wrong if it is wrong? They also don't have that foundation, I think, of kind of this troubled relationship that probably predates them, you know, before their time in the force.
Yeah.
But until we get to that point, until we are able to kind of figure out that part of the step, I don't know how you solve many of the, you know, whether it's gun violence or other crime issues that we face in our community, but just as society, that we have everyone see those in law enforcement in a positive light.
Well, and so that you say that you talk about community relations, right? And so I want to skip ahead a little bit, just a little bit, because, you know, in speaking to community members, many efforts on behalf of the police to improve community relations feel disingenuous at best and really ineffective and possibly a waste of money at worst. And in some cases, people believe that what's actually happening during these efforts is intelligence gathering to use against citizens later. What are some realistic, tangible outcomes and efforts to improve relations between police and the people in the communities where they police?
Well, that's interesting. And I hadn't thought of it in that way. So you just said that way. But, you know, what I hear a lot, and so somebody that works in the same building I work stopped me not too long ago and was telling me a story about growing up African-American in North Champaign. And his relationship with police then was different, he says, than it is now, in that he said, you know, you saw police, they were, you know, the old expression, walking the beat. They weren't in their squad cars. They were out in the community, they knew my parents, they knew me. And so it was more of, so say a kid was being a typical, you know, 12-year-old, acting, you know, silly with their friends. Instead of, I'm going to make an arrest, or I'm going to come and I'm call reinforcements and make this a really big issue. He said, you know, the officer walk up and he said him by name, and he goes, I need to say, you know, your mom wouldn't like it if she heard you were doing that. And you know, that was the biggest fear I had, was that, you know, when I went home, and it was the trust you saw on both sides, where the local law enforcement one knew who his family was, clearly he was invested enough in the community, not just show up, punch a time clock and take off, but that was his, you know, precinct, beat, whatever you want to call it, his neighborhood that he was in charge of, and from the law enforcement perspective. And so those families he knew well enough to want to see something good come from them. Now, whether that was everybody looks kind of rose colored through the you know, realm of nostalgia, whether that was everybody's experience, I don't know. But I think there is a lot of that where you've seen through the last few decades. I know most of the police officers I worked with as a prosecutor didn't have partners that they went into the community with. They were alone in their squad. And because of that, I think they were more and more dependent on their equipment. So the people in the neighborhood would see a squad car roll in. You got an officer with all their, you know, their computers and everything in the front seat. If you've ever done a ride along, I mean, it's pretty hard for anybody to get in the front seat because they have so much equipment, because they rely on being able to call reinforcements or whatever if something were to happen. But because of that, they're more and more reluctant to get out and to interact with the community. And because of that, you see this complete alienation, right? Where it's like, I don't know that officer by name. It's a foreign person that kind of comes in, never gets out of their car. If they do get out of their car, it's to make an arrest of somebody in the community. And so that's a negative effect, especially to small kids that may not understand all the reasons. So I guess I understand your point to say, well, if you are interacting with the community, is that, you know, is there a nefarious purpose behind that? Is that investigative? But I also think there's just an element of, you should know your community. You should care about its success. You should, you know, want to know those kids by name, because long before in Champaign, obviously gun violence, something we're about, long before they're old enough to be in a crowd that might pick up a gun, They're forming opinions as to what's right and wrong, who is on their side in their neighborhood, who are people they can trust and rely and model their behavior after. And so I think that still is a noble goal. If we're not doing it the right way, I think we need more people at the table to give us ideas.
Right. And so we're going to talk a little bit about some solutions in a second. But listeners, if you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Lamont Holden, filling in for Brian Mackey. Right now, I'm speaking with Illinois State Senator Scott Bennett, who represents the 52nd District of Illinois that includes the greater Champaign area, Danville, Rantoul, and Georgetown. So speaking about solutions, in my research, in the midst of so many examples of misuse of force from police to black individuals, I got really interested in some long-term solutions and ideas about how to address the misuse of force by police. So I started looking into things like defunding the police and ending qualified immunity and decertification. I want to talk to you about what these ideas actually mean and what they would mean for reforming law enforcement. When you hear those terms, like, what are you thinking about as a policymaker today?
Well, a lot of those have really strong connotations that make people. So my style as a legislator is to try to bring different groups together and try to figure out a collaborative solution to these issues, because I don't think any one side has a real grasp of them. So the problems are the minute somebody says defund the police, I think there's a large group of people that say right away, you know, they have in their mind what that means. That means less police on the streets. That means less resources. That means, you know, we're in many ways tying the hands of officers. And so you have a hard time, I think, trying to bridge a gap that exists there. And I know you and I have talked about immunity issues before, and that's something I still don't think, I have not been convinced yet that is what would solve the issue. I have been a supporter of decertifying officers that act inappropriately or act in a way that we all recognize is the wrong thing. What I've said about that, and here's kind of the difference to listeners. Immunity talks about a civil penalty. So if an officer, and you can use the most extreme examples in the Minneapolis example.
Yeah, yeah.
Where that officer, I don't think anyone's going to argue or shouldn't, that officer was acting not in the way that he should have been trained or the way that the police standards would encourage.
I believe it was so, she said she mistook her taser for her gun for her taser, right?
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was talking about George Floyd's
case. I got you.
So in that situation where you got your knee on somebody's neck, that is not in any recognized control maneuver.
Yeah.
But because of that, everyone that has seen that video, I think would recognize, and including law enforcement officers I talked to, what was he, you know, there's no reason to do that unless you're trying to, get the result that he got, quite frankly. And so in that instance, how do you punish an officer that's that far beyond the pale? And so the immunity issue would be, well, you could go, and certainly the city of Minneapolis, I'm quite sure, has been sued or will be sued, or I'm sure they have been already, civilly, mm-hmm. for the actions of their agent, of their employee as a police officer. And so what immunity would do is say, okay, but we want that office, that individual officer, also to be liable for their actions in that instance. And that is something that has been certainly bothers police officers. You know, when you talk to them in the run up to this legislation, when I talked to police groups and said, hey, here's some things you're going to see in these bills, that was usually the first thing that people said back to me is, we're really concerned about the immunity issue.
Mm-hmm.
And what their argument would be is, so now I got to think about every split second decision I made. Yes. I mean, there's no question the most extreme cases like what you saw in Minneapolis is not what we're talking about, but in the split second, small decisions that I make every day on the job, now I have to worry that, you know, some lawyer is going to come back and sue me,
yeah.
and I'm going to lose my house, or I'm going to lose, you know, something I worked for, over what I, you know, is an arguable, disparity from the law.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's their argument. And my kind of comeback to that, I mean, in terms of why I don't think it's very effective, is what will ultimately happen is that when police unions negotiate with their municipalities, they will simply say, we're going to require you to insure us.
Yeah.
So I'm an attorney. And I have a very, I try to look in the same frame. If I did something unethical, if I stole money from a client or did something like that, you could sue me, to be sure. But I have malpractice insurance, mm-hmm. that would come in and take effect and pay that claim.
Right.
That's, I think, what would ultimately happen. And that's at least from the municipal people I talked to said, well, what would ultimately happen is you wouldn't have a deterrent because the cities would end up having to get this insurance.
Right.
And so wouldn't do that. And to me, it's just too small.
Right.
If you have someone who's acting
and Senator Bennett, I am so sorry to cut you off. No, and this is a great conversation, but we're right up against the break. So we're definitely going to hit this back when we come back. I'm Lamont Holden, and you're listening to The 21st.
Support for The 21st comes from Christie Clinic. Christie Clinic, providing health care to the community for more than 90 years. Local procedures, providers, specialties, and choice. Christie Clinic is focused on caring for the community.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Lamont Holden, in for Brian Mackey, and we're talking to State Senator Scott Bennett. Senator, there's so much we want to get to, but I definitely want to tap into something that's been on the minds of the community as I've gotten around town. So gun violence is up 113% in Champaign as of May compared to the same time in the previous year. As of July 14th, Urbana had 55 shootings. There were 53 total in 2020. In my community of Champaign, Urbana, just this last week, I know of 3 murders, 2 including guns. What does Scott Bennett say to the possible solutions to rising gun violence, particularly in the 52nd district?
Well, that's a complicated one. Hope we're not up against another break.
No, you got plenty of time. Talk about it.
2-3 minutes. Well, the fact is, you know, I don't claim to have an easy answer for this, and it's not something, and this is something I have a lot more expertise than most, because I do have a background in the prosecutor's office and did deal with gun cases occasionally there and young people. You know, what we have seen in Champaign-Urbana is that often those cases are interrelated. So I think yesterday the state's attorney said that the shooting in Rantoul was directly related, or at least they believed it was, to the shooting the day before in Urbana. So it's retribution, it's going back and forth.
Yeah.
You have a combination of issues. 2 nights ago in Champaign, about a little after midnight, in downtown near Stratton Elementary, you had a woman shot through her door in her own home. And almost as troubling as that, and that's pretty troubling, is that there were 70 shell casings found there.
Yeah.
So obviously there is either a lot of weapons that were involved in that. And I don't live too far from there and heard the shots and thought it must be fireworks because there were so many of them at the time. But so there's a combination of 2 things. 1, how on earth, if most of the calls I get in my office, people are complaining about things like how hard it is for them to get firearms, how hard it is to get ammunition. There's a backlog at all these things because of, you know, different COVID supply chains. And then, you know, that is in itself, that costs money. There's 70 shells is not an easy thing to get your hands on. So 1, it's this, the propensity of firearms and how easy it is apparently currently to get guns into the community, that obviously, you know, I think most of them are not coming in through the more traditional routes because people say you can't even get firearms, you know, through certain supply chains, but it's coming in somehow. And it's to younger and younger people that don't have a great sense of the consequences of their actions.
Yeah.
I had a friend who prosecuted a case in Decatur who talked about I think they were 15, 16 year olds, and they got into an argument over a woman, a girl, she was by their age. And it was about to come to that point where a lot of teenager fights come where one was going to shove the other one.
Yeah.
And the first guy pulled out a gun and killed his best friend, shot him in the chest.
Oh my God.
And during the As troubling as that is, during the interrogation, the person who did the shooting kept making references like, well, if I could just talk to my friend, and didn't seem to really have a full grasp of, no, you're never going to speak to him again. I mean, it was, he didn't want to kill him. It was, you know, I'm mad at him. I've got to, this is what I have in my hand. This is, and that's what I saw as a prosecutor, is, you know, a group of teenagers on their bikes shooting at one another. She'd have, you know, 10, you know, bullets lodged in a house, but I don't think anyone in the house really thought, I want to kill that person. It's about standing up. It's about, you know, looking tough. It's about maybe getting revenge or scaring somebody back because they disrespected you or somebody that you care about. And it's that next step back and forth. I prosecuted a case in Bloomington where a group of teenagers were trying to join a gang in Bloomington. Mm-hmm. And so they approached this rival gang member who was unloading groceries with his mom. And the guy starts shooting. But if you looked at the house pictures, there's this huge arc of, I mean, clearly he was aiming 5 feet over their heads. Like, he was not trying to shoot these people right in front of him, but he wanted to impress his friends.
Yeah.
And so I those pictures I still think about all the time. Like, there's no way 10 feet away you're aiming 10 feet up.
Yeah.
But I think that's a big part of it. It's like, yes, the problem is he shot a house.
Yeah.
So he didn't know who was in the house. He wasn't thinking that far ahead.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he could have killed an innocent person inside the house, or he could have changed his mind and shot the person anyway. So it's a combination, I think, of young people that don't have enough constructive things to do and a lot of time in their hands. So they're spending that. We always see this in the summer.
Yeah.
And not just in Champaign, where people that they don't have school to go to, a job to go to, something constructive to do, tend to get in trouble. Yeah. And that's always been true. But at the time, you know, a generation ago, it would have been a fist fight in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And now with ready access to firearms, it becomes something much, much more serious and scary to the community. So I think there's what we do know is we can't police our way out of it. You can't simply arrest every person involved in this and then say, well, I'm going to give you a long jail sentence.
Yeah.
Which will keep you off the street. That was a conversation I had with the legislator just in the last 24 hours, that you just got to put these people in jail and never let them out. And the problem is, if you talk, I've had a conversation this week with someone from a local Boys and Girls Club that said, I know some of the kids involved in this and they're good kids, but for, you know, they went out one night and did something ridiculous.
Right.
But I think we'll, you know, be back on a normal path. I mean, they're hanging out at a Boys and Girls Club. So there's something there that they're trying to find positive things to do with their time. So I think it's a community response, and we got to have people, yes, in law enforcement that try to look at it, but also, you know, in the community, there's a lot of clergy here that have been really active and try to figure out how do we get to people in the community, you know, let parents make sure they're keeping an eye on their kids, and not just, you know, to say, don't go out and shoot someone, but also to know where they are and to keep an eye on that. There's no one solution. And that's what's so frustrating when you see people say, well, we got to just, you know, double our police force.
Yeah.
That isn't the end solution. I think there is an element to, if people have respect for their law enforcement and they see there's a law enforcement presence around, they're less likely to do certain crimes. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's clear we have a lot of law office. I mean, there's 14,000 police officers in Chicago. Mm-hmm. That's the shortage of officers is arguably not the reason there's gun violence.
Yeah.
There's always a police officer geographically nearby, but they can't predict what's going to happen. And there's just a lot of people and a lot of guns that are out there causing trouble.
And I appreciate that. And this is always a topic that the community needs to hear more about, and the conversation that we should always be having. It's tough to hear some of those things. But right now, I definitely want to shift gears before we get out of here. And this will probably be our last question. But just real quick. So let's talk about cannabis. Which way did you vote on cannabis legalization and record expungement?
So I voted for the legalization of cannabis and for record expungement. And I will say that was not a sure thing for me.
Yeah.
As a prosecutor, when I came into the General Assembly, I was against it. And it's something that when people come to my office, I would just say, look, I'm for medical marijuana, but I don't think we should go all the way to legalization. And it took a long time to try to study it, to talk about the state, I talked to legislators in California and in Colorado, and tried to see like, all right, all the sky is going to fall stuff you read about, is that what's happened where we've tried it? And ultimately where I came down was that I couldn't delineate a big difference between alcohol and marijuana for adults.
Yeah.
That, you know, there is a social acceptability to somebody working a day and then going and sitting in their neighborhood bar and having a beer or having a cookout with their friends.
Right.
But it's a totally different thing if somebody wants to use cannabis, again, in the privacy of their own homes as adults. And there is, I think there's a racial component to that. There's also a generational component to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have young, I may have mentioned this to you before. I have teenage cousins in a nearby community, and I'd said to them, you know, when they were in high school, hey, look, I drank beer when I was in high school too. Just make sure you don't drive. And one of them said to me, like, I don't touch alcohol. It makes you sick, but I smoke marijuana every day.
Yeah.
One, I wouldn't have known where to get it in my small town, but that I think there's a generational component too, that they would prefer to do that than alcohol. And yet we legally say it's totally fine as long as you're not getting in a car.
Right.
For an adult to do this in their own home.
Uh-huh.
But marijuana, suddenly we're going to come and arrest large groups of people for arguably the same offense. And interestingly enough, most law enforcement officers, I like to bring it back to that.
Yeah.
Were for it. They would say to me, you know, half of my interactions with the community are based on alcohol,
right?
But very few of them are based on cannabis.
And Senator, I think we'll have to leave the conversation there. And man, this has been awesome. Thank you so much.
Sorry,
for joining
25
us.
Minutes isn't enough.
Time. Oh, that I know, and we'll have to bring it back. But my guest has been Illinois State Senator Scott Bennett. Scott Bennett, thank you so much for joining me on the 21st.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.